All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. All right, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast, a Flynnless episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast, which is an absolute crying shame, to be honest.
Disappointing, man, but, you know, life gets in the way sometimes. And we couldn't rearrange it because both of us had obligations tomorrow night. So sadly missed, but hopefully he'll be back for next week.
And I think he's taken out, hopefully taken out a senorita to dinner tonight. He said he's going for a meal. He's going out for dinner. Hopefully he's taking a bird out.
I know Carita. Definitely. Yeah. Good luck, Flynn, if you're listening back. Yeah, which you definitely will.
So, yeah. So. Let us know on the podcast next week how it went. All right, so we'll get off the preamble ramble this week. Is David Moyes the best British manager in the country right now? With the exception of perhaps my nemesis, Gareth Southgate. Moyes has engineered Premier League wins over Chelsea, Tottenham, Liverpool, and EFL Cup wins over United and Man City. And also, quite remarkably, they have not lost a game by more than one goal in their last 40, which is the longest run in Europe's top five leagues. Doesn't show up on stat sheets, but it gives you a sense of how Moyes has transformed West Ham into a team that are extremely difficult to play against. What do you make of this?
At the risk of putting you on the spot, but I think you will have a fair idea, where were West Ham before Moyes got involved?
Like relegation battling.
Actually. And they had their new stadium, they had all that outgoings, you know, all the pressure as an Arsenal fan, I'm fully aware of the pressures that a new stadium can bring. To have, whether they were, let's just say they were lower half of the table. Say they were knocking around 17th, 16th, maybe 14th, whatever, but flirting with that kind of area. Where they are now, I mean, they turned over Chelsea the other day. And Chelsea are, well, the league leaders, if not, they're like second and looking pretty decent, man. Like, smashing Juve away and all that in the Champions League. Not away, but, you know, smashing them. How do you account for the changes that he's been able to make? Like, West moves, like, putting, what's his name, Antonio up front. That seems like a little bit of a gimmicky thing to point to. To make these kind of improvements, surely he must have made a complete overhaul of their training, their tactics, their just general coaching. So, just, what do you think it is, man?
And this is going to be a huge theme of the football section of this episode, really. It's about how much emphasis we should put on a new manager coming in and embedding his own philosophy. And we're going to talk about Ralph Rangnick and what he's potentially going to do at United a little bit later. But obviously Moyes, he took over West Ham when the team were in the relegation zone. And his first game in charge was he lost his first game in charge, but since then, and obviously we're going about the honeymoon period and, you know, sort of how many managers win their first games, but they stuck with him. And I don't think he was kind of I wouldn't have said at the time when West Ham brought him in, he was a very lucrative kind of guy to bring in for the West Ham, because West Ham fans, I think they have got a high standard. Like, I remember when, and I'm not sure if I mentioned this last week, when Sam Allardyce was their coach, I remember West Ham booing after they'd won at home 2-1. They actually booed Allardyce after they'd won because of the style of play. So, obviously, West Ham fans expect a lot. But Moyes seems to be bringing both at the minute. They beat Liverpool and Tottenham, what, 3-2? Oh, no, Liverpool and Chelsea. They both beat 3-2 in the league this year. So, a fantastic achievement. If he can get them anywhere near the top four, I'd say, you know, even if he can get them top six, top seven, Europa League football again, that'd be a momentous achievement for him.
Well, this is what he was doing at Everton before the United job happened. So, it's not as if he hasn't got form in this area. We went through this extensively the other week. I think it was the week you were absent, actually. That the just how much of a poison chalice the United job has been, and maybe Ralph Ragnarok. He's had a good start, but you don't know how this is going to turn out. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of backroom shenanigans. A lot of boardroom shenanigans that I'm speculating on, obviously. But that seems to be the way it's going. On a coaching level, Moyes is like just a straight G, isn't it? Like, I think he had to recover in terms of public perception after the Man United job. So he went to Real Sociedad. I wasn't even aware he went to Sunderland. And that's like twice he's took over from Sam Allardyce, isn't it? So it seems to be that the big man with the slick back hair ain't doing the job. They bring in Moyes and he elevates the level. They play like wicked football under Moyes as well, do you know what I mean?
And to be fair, I didn't recall that he actually left the job at West Ham United after 6 months of his initial contract, and he came back. I don't actually remember him doing that. I think I've just merged both of the times he was there into one. So I think in that initial period, that's when he kind of like transformed Mikel Antonio into the striker that he is now. obviously West Ham's all-time Premier League goal scorer. So that's coaching, man. That's serious, proper coaching, isn't it? And transforming a player's position.
And not to undermine what Klopp, what Pep, and what Tuchel have done, but he's doing it with a team that aren't yet there. They're not yet knocking on the door. To take him from basically the bottom of the league to the top is a whole different brand of achievement. So based on that, you'd have to say at the minute at least, now this might change going towards the end of the season, but you'd have to put him up there at least. If he's not the top, he's like top two or three for sure.
Yeah, and you know, obviously I don't think they've had the same kind of resources that the big six. You wouldn't put him in the big six, would you? Obviously.
No.
So they haven't got. He hasn't had the same resources to work with, and the same like sort of war chest as they call it when Roman Abramovich first came into Chelsea. So he's doing a great job with kind of, I don't want to say limited resources, because they have...
They've
got enough. And obviously they've got that new stadium and how much... But whenever there's a team that moves to a new stadium, there's owners are usually a little bit more frugal with finances as well, as we've seen with Tottenham, and their move to the new stadium. But what's the kind of roadmap for West Ham actually finishing the top four? I think they need to be fortunate. They need to avoid injuries, like you know Leicester did when they won the title. They were very fortunate in the way that they avoided injuries. They avoided losing their key players, and also they weren't competing on other fronts, so they weren't competing in other competitions. West Ham haven't got that, so they are going to make a Europa League run this season. And I think the deeper they get into that competition, the more they're going to want to stay there. Obviously, they've already lost Angelo Bonner, who plays as a centre-back. They've lost Kurt Zouma, who also plays in that position. So it's looking like he's going to be out for a considerable amount of time. So I think they will have to dip into the transfer market at some point this month.
If you're a West Ham fan, would you rather them make a serious run in the Europa League? Because if you win that, you get into the Champions League anyway, don't you? Or do you consolidate your resources? Because there's no guarantee you're going to get anyone good in January and make a proper run at the league, get that fourth position. They amount to the same thing, but because the Europa League fixtures are dotted throughout, and the Premier League fixtures are basically week after week, notwithstanding the dreaded internationals. What do you think is the better route to success? Like Europa League or the league, the Premier League?
Yeah, so obviously they're going to play their match day six, so the final group stage of Europa League, this Thursday. They are already qualified, so they qualified through, so they'll be playing the, what is it, will it be the last 32, I think, because obviously you get the Champions League teams that drop down from whoever finishes third in the Champions League drops down into Europa League, don't they? So Barcelona could be one of those teams.
Imagine that, West Ham Barcelona.
So, do you know what I mean? So at the London Stadium, like, that would be a good...
You'd fancy West Ham to turn them over, to be fair.
I tell you what, you wouldn't want to back Barcelona, would you? I don't. So, to your question... if I was a West Ham fan, I'd want to focus on the league, man. I probably would want to focus on the league. Obviously, they're not going to win it. Like, that's beyond the realms of comprehension. But fourth, you know, it's realistic. It's realistic. But, you know, as we're going to talk about the next team that we're going to talk about, Manchester United, they're also going to be really challenging for that fourth position. And obviously, they've got Ralf Rangnick, their new manager, the German messiah, the godfather of German football, as he's been coined. So, you know, he's going to be embedding his new philosophies. And that's what we were talking about, sort of how much emphasis we put on coaches that bring a new style and a new culture into a club.
Well, on the Twitter spaces that you did the other night for the FA Cup draw, which was like, I really enjoyed listening to that. We had you, Tino, Stitch, and a couple of listeners chiming in as well. And I think it was it Mohamed, the United fan?
Yep.
He was saying that the first half of that game was like the best he'd seen United play all season. So that's a United fan saying that. I didn't watch the full game. I seen your best mate Fred come up with an absolute scream to win the game. But I find it hard to envisage how a team can turn around dismal form so quickly when a manager's only just come through the door. So maybe you can talk us through where Rangnick comes from, what his style is, why he's so highly regarded.
Yeah, so I was reading a little bit about Martin Keown's tactical breakdown about the way he likes to play, his philosophy, and this 4-2-2-2 system, which we haven't really seen much of. Obviously, you've got two holding midfielders, then you've got two more advanced midfielders, then you're two strikers. But he's essentially one of the first advocates of this pressing, this Gegen pressing system that Jurgen Klopp likes to employ for Liverpool. And he was actually head coach of Hoffenheim in 2008 when his side beat Jurgen Klopp's Borussia Dortmund. So Klopp apparently said that after seeing the way Wreck-It Ralph had his team set up to play, I don't think he used that term.
But, sure, you shouldn't even rob that from Klopp.
But he wanted to embody that style of football for his own. So he obviously he was enamoured, Klopp was enamoured by the way he set up his sides to play. So I think, and obviously Ranić has got, he's got a sort of a foot in the realm of, I want to sort of bring the mental and the, you know, the mental component of football into the Manchester United system as well, because he's going to be bringing in a sports psychologist for the first time in 20 years since Steve McClaren was the first team coach.
Well, judging from what all the pundits are saying and from what Man United fans in general say, that might be the missing component. The fact that they don't seem, the last days of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager, regardless of him finishing second in the league and getting to the final of the Europa, it did seem like they just couldn't be asked anymore, like the players. And it probably, the fact that they were so effective in the first game under Ranić probably supports that, do you know what I mean? So if he's the quintessential man manager, if he's able to say to them, look, you guys are all talented enough, you've been playing football since you were kids, I need commitment and I need determination and I need just to run until your legs can't run no more. If he was able to get that point across quickly enough, that would account for the improved quality of United so far.
Because, and I've got a couple of points to get through, because I think the whole idea of gegenpressing is to try and win the ball back as quickly as possible. So I'd say there are two main components, or maybe three main components of how you make that happen. All your players need to be ultra fit, so you need to work on the physicality aspect of it. All your players need to be very, very concentrated, and they need to make sure that they know exactly what they're doing in those moments. And thirdly, also, you need to have discipline. So you need to be disciplined in terms of, all right, I need to listen to what my coach is saying. I need to try and embed exactly what he's saying on the pitch. But for me, it doesn't seem like rocket science to say that, all right, if we lose the ball, let's try and win it back as quickly as possible. And, you know, obviously, Marcelo Bielsa got lauded with praise when he brought this new style to the Premier League. So I find it absolutely baffling that there's teams in the Premier League now, or that Man United, one of the biggest teams on the planet, didn't have a sports psychologist. Because Ranić said, I can't, basically he was saying, I can't believe it, because every team in Germany's got one.
That seems to me like, first of all, it seems like a personality thing, because when someone's telling you to do something, whether you do it or not basically amounts to trust, doesn't it? They throw this out in very broad strokes in punditry. They no longer believe in the manager. But what does that really mean? It means that I'm either not getting along with this guy, he's told me to do things in the past and it hasn't worked out. Maybe there's a lot of shifting of the blame. Maybe a lot of players don't want to take responsibility for that. Do you know what I mean? The poorer performances that Man United have had, maybe it's easier to blame the manager. But getting a sports psychologist in, if it's not an all-round Premier League vibe, if it's not something people generally do, then I think you will see like massive improvements. I mean, I don't know if, like, to be fair, there are a lot of international players in United's squad, and maybe they've experienced it at different points throughout their careers, and maybe they're not getting that at United, and maybe that's the extra key. I'm really quite interested to see. Like, Man United have been the focus of a lot of our attention since we started the pod, because they are like a massive club and all that, and it's fascinating to see them in this period of recovery. And this, they're selling Ranić to us as if he's the man, he's the saviour, and I haven't felt, even under Mourinho, he didn't get this kind of endorsement. Do you know what I mean? So many high-level coaches praise him and his approach, and these coaches are doing bits as well. I'm thinking this might be the guy, man. I mean, I don't know what his contract or what his role is going to be in the next season or so, but judging from what they're saying and the initial game at least, it's optimistic.
I think he's the head coach for an initial six-month term, but he's going to be part of the football operations for at least 2 years.
Nice.
And for me, that sounds like they're seriously buying into what he's trying to do here. And to be honest, I don't blame them. I don't blame the Man United board for seeing his potential, because I think he's proved that he's got the ability to do it, because he's worked with the Red Bull teams. And he's actually brought in the New York Red Bull coach as well, the ex-New York Red Bull head coach. So he's going to be, I think, his first team coach. So now you're talking of him building an actual philosophy within Man United. It's hard to believe that they haven't had one for such a long time since Fergie left. But that's the way it's been, man, since, you know, for 5, 6, what, 7 years now, is it?
Since the great man left.
Was it 2013, since the great man left?
2013.
Praise be.
Praise be.
But it just shows you the levels that he's going to be bringing to the club. And, you know, this is what kind of what Klopp was doing when he was at Dortmund. He set up the football now, which was kind of this this indoor arena that had sort of like test drills where players would go in and they'd receive balls from really odd positions, and it would test your reaction time. And it's all about tuning the brain.
I've watched some of the reaction drills that Liverpool do, and it's mad. It's like they're literally on their toes, and I think they listen to like a starting pistol or something. And it's like, bang, how fast can you react to this? Where they don't know where it's coming from.
Yep.
And that's why, obviously, Liverpool, you've seen the team they've been over the past couple of years. It's from a sports, just general sports perspective, it's fascinating to see it developing on this. And it's so publicly as well, because we're going to get to see it, man. Back in the day, it would have been like, oh, he's doing quite well. You'd have had to rely on the Sun or the Daily Mail or whatever to get these bits of information. But now it's going to be part of the promotion for Man United. It's going to be, I'm really looking forward to it, man.
Well, without going down sort of a data analytics, like kind of like wormhole, this is basically the start of like sabermetrics in football. And that, well, the start started a long time ago, but it's kind of like starting to become a little bit more mainstream, obviously with the emergence of like expected goals and now using metrics in terms of like analysing player performance. So we're really starting to become more like baseball in a way, and the way baseball's viewed. And I think we're starting to get out with the old, oh, I've got a good feeling he's a good player. Like, cause
it's actually Moneyball, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it's starting to become like Moneyball, because at the end of the day, we don't want coaches and managers saying, you know what, he did really well at training this week, or he had a really good game. I felt like he had a really good game last week. But it's I don't want your opinion on whether he had a good game. I want the data. I want the physical data on what he did. Do you know what I mean? I want to know how many passes he completed. I want to know how many forward passes he completed. I want to know how many times he split defensive lines. You know what I mean? Because if you're going to play a player like Fred or like Bruno Fernandes,
yeah. You
need to know these things. And obviously, you know, we spoke about Fred and him being a destroyer. Like, that's what I like to call him. Like, I want him to do his job. And I think Ralph Rangnick's going to buy into this. He's going to be like, Fred, this is what you're good at, man. This is what you're good at. You're good at pressing. You're good at hassling. You're good at winning the ball, right? You're good at making sure that opponents don't have a time to think, because it's all about time and it's all about seconds and how quickly you can perform. So I think he's going to say things like that to him, and then just give the ball to somebody that's got the ability to play that pass, that killer pass. So he seems to be already getting the best out of Fred. So it's hard to say. I don't know whether he's had a word with him or not, but potentially that's something that he might have done.
Well, let's not jump the gun too quickly, because we've done this several times on the pod, especially when it comes to the demise or the success of some. But I can actually say I feel optimistic about it, and especially if so many people are singing his praises, then, you know, it can't be all smoke and mirrors. Do you know what I mean? So we'll see.
All right, and obviously we'll move on to a quick word on Stevie G's Villa, because he's won 3 out of 4 now, and obviously the only loss was that to Man City, which was a close one as well. And I think they had chances to tie that game as well. And hopefully we should be getting Stitch on next week, who's a massive Villa fan, season ticket holder. So he's going to tell us in more detail how he's transformed the team.
Wicked, man. He was good. Oh, yeah, he was on the Twitter Spaces as well, wasn't he?
Yep.
Yeah, really looking forward to that. Hopefully he can find time to get it on.
But once again, another manager that's come into a club. I think we've had 6 new managers in the Premier League, and I can't think of one that's not got off to a good start. Obviously, you've got Dean Smith that's gone at Norwich. I think they won the first game he's in charge. Villa have won 3 out of 4. Rangnick won his first game in charge. Eddie Howe had a slower start, but Newcastle just got their first win of the season after 15.
Yeah, and he looked like
15 games.
He looked like the weight of the world was lifted off his shoulders when they won that game as well. And you can understand as well, so many expectations after the takeover, and Newcastle are not really, I don't know what they're on, man. They don't seem like a team that's fit for the Premier League at the moment, to be honest. And if he can turn it around in the second half of the season, fair play to him, man.
And then just to round off the sort of, you know, who's the best British manager, as it was the kind of initial topic at the start of this episode. Obviously, you've got Stevie G. You've got Eddie Howe, who we just mentioned. You've got Sean Dyche at Burnley, who's kind of been given a longer term contract. He's been there for a long time now. But you can't really argue with that, can you? Who's a better manager, British manager in the league? Brendan Rodgers, would you say he's a better manager than David Moyes at the minute?
Interesting that, because Leicester have been slipped. Oh, at the minute, are we saying, like right now? Are we saying like, because that's very much like a form thing, and you'd have to say Moyes, wouldn't you? But what Brendan Rodgers has done, I mean, I know he didn't win the league with Leicester, and in fact, this year they've been sliding so hard. But that Liverpool team you had back in the day, they were like the closest thing to winning a league before Klopp came in. Those are very lofty standards. I know he went away to Celtic and came back. He's for me, he's top quality. I think he might have just run his time out at Leicester, and you know, aging squad, all that kind of stuff. Moyes, as we've said, it's very hard to make a case against him. But I will say for Sean Dyche, to take Burnley to Europe, as he did a few seasons ago. I know they didn't really go anywhere, but to take that, such an unfashionable team with lack of funds, with basically like no expectations whatsoever, to stay in the league, even as like forget Europe, to stay in the Premier League, to not go up and down, like we've seen so many clubs do, even massive clubs like Newcastle, he deserves a lot of credit over the long term.
And playing pragmatic football as well, it's very, very difficult to keep a team playing at the same standard, playing defensive football, and that's what he's done for a considerable amount of time. And they've spent nothing. I think Maxwell Cornet, who they signed this season, I think he's the biggest signing of all time, most expensive signing of all time. I don't think he was that much. I think he was like under 10 million or something.
What do you think he got? What do you think Dyche got his long-term contract? He balances the books and he keeps him in the league. That's what you want.
Basically, what Wenger was doing for, well, not keeping the league, but he was keeping him in Europe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he was doing it on the other spectrum, do you know what I mean? He was balancing books and keeping Arsenal in Europe. I think they went, what, how many years did they go in Europe? 17? Was it 17 years consecutively, something like that?
That's a fair comparison, though. Like you say, a team who's not realistically going to win the league, not realistically going to win the Champions League after a certain point, after 2007, 2008. But he kept them up there, kept the revenue coming in, kept those young signings coming in, top quality, just to keep you where you're at, just to keep maintaining. And for a lot of clubs, maintenance is enough, I think.
Right, we'll move on to the German football, because there was a big fixture, the biggest fixture, the Der Klassiker, between Borussia Dortmund and Bayern Munich. And it was a thriller, and we watched the sort of end of it.
Yeah, yeah, I saw the last, it was 3-2 when I walked in. So
just before we started the boxing chat.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So I was watching through this, good start for Dortmund. Obviously, they got off to a fast start. I think Julian Brandt scored the goal. And then obviously, the inevitable Lewandowski got on the score sheet. So there was a lot of controversy surrounding this game as well. Obviously, Jude Bellingham has been fined. I think he got fined €40,000 for his comments after the game.
Yeah, for what? Disagreeing with the referee's decision? Come on, this is similar to the five things we said about that rugby player a couple of weeks ago. I think that's ridiculous. You should be allowed to disagree with what's going on. I'm sorry. But if he doesn't think that this... I don't even know what the situation is. Honestly, I don't. But he should be able to comment on it. He's a player. It's his job. If the referee said something about one of the players, I wouldn't expect him to get fined. Do you know what I mean? The other way around. So what's the counter argument there?
So I think I've listened to this, and Simon Jordan would probably disagree with you. Mind you, he disagrees with most people, but he would certainly have a different opinion on this. I think he has a bit of an agenda against players, though. But he would say that, you know, an 18-year-old footballer, straight after a kind of a sore loss against one of your biggest rivals in the league, and he actually criticised the referee, who has had match fixing claims in the past. So I think it was in 2005, he had actually took a bribe after I think the guy's name was Felix Weyer. This is the referee. So he took a bribe in 2005 and was banned in 2006 for 6 months by the German FA for accepting a bribe. To avoid critical scenes in a game in the lower leagues. Obviously, he was banned and it was kept hush-hush. This is the weirdest thing. It was kept hush-hush by the German FA, and it wasn't until a German newspaper spilled the beans on it that it became apparent. And then, obviously, Jude Bellingham was aware of that, and all the Borussia Dortmund players would have been aware of it prior to the game. And then you've got the two contentious penalty decisions. Now, the Marco Reus decision, if you haven't seen it and no one else has seen it, I don't know how realistically, in this day and age, and the VAR system that we have implemented, I think Germany were the first country to implement VAR. I don't know how that doesn't even go to review. The referee didn't even review it.
Sketch.
He didn't even want to look at it. And I'm telling you, it is a penalty all day long. Like, Marco Reus has got the wrong side of him. I can't remember.
Let's take a quick break now, right? And what we're going to do, we're going to pause just for a second. We're going to look at the decision, and then we're going to be back in just a moment with both of our opinions. That's a fucking penalty.
It is, isn't it? All day long.
That's a fucking penalty.
And they didn't even review it. So yeah, after we just had a quick watch, because I wanted you to see it as well. Initial thoughts on the Marco Reus challenge in the box?
Straight away, I said, that is a penalty. He's the defender's coming behind him. Haaland's played a very nice one-touch pass there to slide him in. But the defender has literally got his right forearm on his back and shoved him over. Now, as you say, at first glance, and the game being played at the speed that it's being played at, you can be forgiven for the referee not to call it a penalty straight away. But for that not to go to review, as you say, in this day and age of VAR, like, what? Like, are you not pulling up anything there? Like, how did Hummels get the handball called? Because you saw some of the sketch going on. Obviously, we pull it up, we review it, and then we get on with the game. The decision's a decision. That's the whole point of VAR. Why did they not review that?
I can't understand that. It's not all on Felix Weyer. It's on the guys that are in the booth, or, you know, the fourth official, or whatever you want to call him, the guy reviewing this stuff. He must have another look at it in slow-mo. And in slow motion, I know it's, you know, these things always seem a lot more egregious when you watch them, like, slowly. When you break it down, in real time, it looked like it was a bit of a shove there. But when you really break it down, he doesn't win the ball. Like, he's on the wrong side of him. And he definitely clips his feet. He definitely takes his feet away from him.
It's a penalty.
There's no way you can't think it's a penalty. So I think that's what, you know, that's why where Jude Bellingham's comments stem from.
What did he actually say, Jude? Oh, Jude.
He said something along the lines of, you know, when you've got a guy that's match fixed in the past, refereeing the biggest game in German football, what do you expect?
I'm not being funny. I rate you for saying that. And whoever was it Simon Jordan who intimated that his age was a factor? Listen, he's old enough to be on that team. He's old enough to be playing in front of 60,000 people, Champions Leagues, all that. He's old enough to be saying his piece about it. I'm sorry, I'd be saying that same thing.
Mate, I thought he held himself well when he spoke about it. As when he speaks, for an 18-year-old, you want to see this guy speak. He speaks like a co-commentator, man.
Big
he
man
actually
like Jude.
Kills it, man.
No, I'm not being funny.
I ain't just saying it because I'm a Birmingham fan and, like, he's from Brum.
Yeah.
But, like, he held himself really well. And, like, he was saying what he thought. And it wasn't rash. It didn't seem like he was saying it out of anger or out of spite. So what we'll do is we'll have a quick listen to Jude's comments.
How did you see the penalty that finally kind of decided this game?
Well, for me it wasn't. You know, he's not even looking at the ball and he's fighting to get it and it hits him. I don't even think he's looking at the ball. But, you know, you can look at a lot of the decisions in the game. You know, you give a referee that's, you know, match fixed before the biggest game in Germany. What do you expect?
Is that why you feel as a player when things like that decide a game, that someone sitting in the bus kind of tell the referee, have a look, and no other player complained about it?
Yeah, it's frustrating. I know I've not seen it properly, but I definitely think Marco's up there. I don't know what you have to do to be able to get a foul checked. I can understand, yeah, they've checked it, and if it's his hand, okay, but for me, it was looking away, and that one up there, I don't get how you can't check it, but... You know, I'm not a referee. He apparently is, so...
And listen, think about, take into consideration how fuming you'd be. Any reasonable person would be fuming about that. He's still giving the referee and the officiating staff overall full benefit of the doubt. He's saying, listen, I'm not a referee. I'm not in the booth. He's always saying that. And to bring up the fact that he'd match fixed in the past, or been involved in match fixing in the past, and saying, what do you expect? That, to me, does not seem like a rash statement at all.
And, like, you talk about Miss Rossi back in the English days, man, when we were at school. She talks about point, evidence, and an explanation.
Yeah.
What has that geezer just done?
Yeah, that's right.
He's made his point. He's gave the evidence to why he feels that way, right? And he's explained it, man.
Yeah.
There was nothing for me. And he was getting investigated by German police. They were talking about him potentially, I don't know, not doing time, like, but, yeah, like... Being investigated.
I'll tell you what now, I'm not a Blues fan, I'm not a Dortmund fan. I didn't see him play much in the England squad, but I'm a big Jude fan now. After seeing that, definitely fair play to him. He's a nipper, saying things like
18 years old, man. Right. The way he handled himself.
Absolutely right. Fair play. I'll be watching him now. Probably not watching him all the time.
Me and you were shitting ourselves on this podcast when we were first starting out, like.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
What I mean? And he's got up there like with a mic, 18 years old, no problems, and said something like that. And, you know, really spoke for the whole of Borussia Dortmund, like all the staff, all the players, all the fans, man. He spoke for everybody.
Sick. Oh, I'm gassed now. Give me goosebumps. That did a little bit.
Right. So we're gonna move. To the women's game. The women's FA Cup final was on Saturday afternoon. Unfortunately for you, Arsenal ladies lost 3-0 to Chelsea.
Well, to be fair, in the men's game, that result wouldn't shock me so much. But Arsenal women's are like, they're pretty sick, aren't they? So I've got no contextual knowledge to offer at all. I didn't even realise it was on. So I'm such a misogynist. I'm sorry.
To be fair, I didn't until I sat down in the pub. But Sam Kerr got a couple of goals. Frank Kirby scored one. It was, to be fair, I'm sounding condescending already.
Sam Kerr, we watched her in the summer, didn't we? Yeah. She was good, man.
Well, was that a year ago? Was that 2020? Might have been. I think it was 2020.
It must have been this year, man. Olympics.
The Olympics. Was it, Sam Kerr, yeah. I was starting to sound condescending there. To be fair, it was pretty good quality. But no, honestly, the game was played at a good tempo. There was lots of quality. I'm still kind of sceptical about why, or confused as well, as to why the goalkeeping is considerably poorer than the outfield players play. I don't get it.
From the little bit, and I have watched only a little bit of women's football, mostly during this year's Olympics, that seems to be where the gap in quality between the men's game and the women's game is the most evident. I don't know if it's a size thing.
I think it's an athleticism thing, because you think about it, when you're an outfield player, what are the attributes that make you a good footballer?
We need
technique, cardio, stamina, cardio. Mm-hmm. They're things that where women can closely match men. And whereas I think athleticism, being able to dive like 3 yards in a split second.
Well, you're talking stuff like standing jumps, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about. You're talking like basically like slam dunk types, like NFL combine type explosive movements, reaction time, all that. I don't know what the data is on that, women compared to men, but there does seem to be a lot of... I think size is definitely an issue, because you see like lads like Alisson, De Gea, all that, and what's his name for PSG?
Donnarumma.
Donnarumma. When they spread their arms, they're taking up a hefty portion of the goal, and I've never seen a female goalkeeper with that kind of stature. That's obviously going to play a part in it.
Like huge wingspan, like a sort of bird of prey, isn't
it? Yeah, like albatross, like Carl Froch, isn't it?
Huge. But I think the issue with me, and I was watching this and I was thinking, yeah, it's pretty good stand. I was enjoying watching it. The goals were great. But I was thinking, what a mammoth gap in quality between this, like what we're watching now, and the sort of like teams that England spanked, was it Latvia 20-0? And you had like Northern Ireland beating another team like 10-0.
Yeah, up the Northern Ireland, man.
And
sweet,
you just had teams that were getting absolutely spanked in the qualifiers. And where, you know, in a way, this was a good advert for women's football. But when you compare it to what all the sort of lesser nations are doing, and you know, the countries that haven't had the sort of like more the exposure that the women's league has in this country, like how does football sort of how does it narrow that gap between the best and the worst teams?
Well, it's exactly the same as in the men's game. San Marino, Luxembourg, fucking, you know, North Macedonia, they're always going to get, well, not always, 9 out of 10 times they're going to get absolutely walloped by Germany, Italy, Spain, England. It's just the way it is. If your country hasn't got the infrastructure, hasn't got the funding, hasn't got the exposure, you haven't got the population, that's a massive factor as well. You know, Latvia's population is much more than England's. 20-0, no infrastructure, no star players, no one to look up to. There's not girls growing up in Latvia who can look up to famous footballing idols. Do you know what I mean? These are all factors, you know. But I think it's a really encouraging sign that we're seeing these female teams, national and club level. Look, they're actually establishing their own thing. I know it's been going on for years and years, but it was never part of my, like, growing up, I never watched women's football. It was never a thing. It was never something I was invited to do, never something anyone was gassed about. And now it's becoming more like that. It's a positive thing.
But I still don't think, I mean, if you look at the last 15 years, we'll go for the last 15 years of FA Cup winners.
Arsenal,
Charlton, Arsenal, Everton, Arsenal, Birmingham City, which was a fluke, and then they played in the Champions League. Arsenal, Arsenal, Chelsea, Arsenal, Man City, Chelsea, Man City, Man City, Chelsea. So clearly, there isn't much in terms of, you know, the lesser teams, but the teams that aren't in that upper echelon. In the standards.
This is like watching like Real Madrid back in the Di Stefano days. They're they're putting together leagues and leagues and leagues. Celtic, Rangers, they're putting together leagues and leagues and leagues. To me, this is following the pattern of the men's game. Literally to the letter, I think.
So that's probably a good thing then for women's football. Hopefully that should increase. Because I think, having the more teams that are competitive, obviously that's going to improve the overall quality of the league, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's going to make the whole quality of the league better. And in turn, that usually makes the national teams better as well. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, with exception to, which I'm very, very baffled about. I know this is a bit of a massive, massive sort of like detour about what we're talking about. But
was it Tom Arnold Schwarzenegger did that?
Ah, you had to get it in there.
That's for you, Flynn.
But this will be the last note on this. And the last sort of note on the football, then we get into the five things. But I was thinking, like, and I've said this before to Ben Pritchard, and he was like, nah, mate. And now I'm starting to agree with him, because I said that the Serie A was probably on the level of Premier League. Like, I think I said it maybe about 6 months ago. But after watching AC Milan last night and how Liverpool's B team just, like, calmly disposed of them.
Salah played though, Mane played.
Yeah, they were the only two sort of like starters that played. And they both got brought off after 65 minutes. And Liverpool still managed to just don the match out.
Yeah, I understand. I agree with you. I didn't want, yeah.
And they're top of Serie A at the minute, AC Milan.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, how did Italy manage to win the Euros, right? They won the Euros and they won it fairly comfortably. They were blitzing teams in the group stage, and obviously then they beat England in the final. How is there no correlation between the quality of the Serie A, and all their players seem to play in the Serie A as well?
Different teams, though, isn't it?
So yeah, but you'd think that they'd sort of bring that kind of. You think there'd be some kind of correlation between, you know, the teams in the Champions League, but it seems like who are the best four teams right now in world football? In European football.
If you look at AC Milan's lineup yesterday, how many of those players were starting for Italy?
I think potentially two.
Two.
I think Florenzi, was he in the Italy team? Because a lot of their players seem to be from like Udinese, Atalanta, Inter, I think, have got a few.
So AC Milan, the team, might not be a fair... doesn't fairly equate to Italy, is what I'm trying to get at, basically. They might be the poorer representation of the Italian national squad, whereas... Atalanta, Udinese, Inter, Juventus. They might have more players, and they might be. You know, the season's not over yet. Do you know what I mean? AC Milan haven't won the league yet, so.
And you'd be hard pressed to not say that Chelsea, and this is my top four. I'd say Chelsea, Liverpool, Man City, and Bayern Munich are the four best teams in European football at the minute.
Yeah, that's been finished.
You can't really argue with that, can you? Yeah. I think Real Madrid or Barcelona get in there.
Real Madrid, I put them a fair like head and shoulders, but Barca at the minute.
Probably be fifth.
Yeah, I put them fifth, yeah. Well, PSG, sixth. I'd probably put PSG above. Actually, that's a fair fifth and sixth, PSG, Real Madrid. But yeah, not much in it, I suppose.
Yeah, but they can't really break into it because they haven't really progressed past the semi finals.
Mm. And they've looked ropey in Europe this season already, so yeah, you're right.
But yeah, but in a way, English football, we have seen that an improvement under Southgate as well, but I wonder how much of that is down to the improvement of the Premier League as well. And also that goes back to how much resources have been pumped into
the
Premier League.
The Premier League's always been considered, if not the top, well, especially by our journalists, but one of the top two or three leagues in the world. And Southgate needs to be, I think history is going to be like Lennox Lewis, man. History is going to be kinder to him than the present is, I think.
And I think it's only going to get further and further away from the quality of the other leagues as well, with obviously the takeover at Newcastle United. That's kind of set precedent for like the future takeovers with clubs. And it's like, right, if I want to make a team great, I probably can in 5 years, with the exception of maybe Everton and what they've done there.
But yeah, exactly.
It's kind of, it's a bit of a roulette wheel, really, isn't it, when it comes to sort of like club management in the Premier League. Right, Russell, should we get on with the five things you might have missed?
Yeah, let's. Quick word on the Ashes, is it?
Quick word on the Ashes. So it started last night in Brisbane, and England are off to an absolute nightmare start, and were bowled out for 147. I think I'll just put that in there and not fact check it at all. So hopefully it was. But I do remember somebody on Twitter saying something about snooker, so I think that was the reference to the 147. Did they get extra points for doing the 147?
That's a bold admittance, that is.
But Pat Cummins, he took a fifer, which means he got 5 wickets on the day. And it was his first day as captain as well, so fair play to him. But Rory Burns, the England opener, was bowled. He was bowled first ball of the whole series. So that, you know, it was like, and welcome. The commentator was like, and welcome to the first ball of the series.
He was batting.
And Rory Burns was batting, yeah. And he got fucking bowled, and it like
straight. Like,
yeah. It was just like he got caught around the wicket. The ball swung behind his legs and like clattered his leg stump. I used to watch a lot more cricket, but when the Ashes was on, I'll always try and get behind it. But it was on at like, it started at like 12 o'clock last night, midnight, and it. So I watched the first like 20 minutes, and like England were like 3 for 11 or something. And I was like, man, this is gonna be disgusting. I'm
call it a night.
But because like, I think England would probably have to bowl Australia out now on day two for like under 200 if they want any chance of winning. I think chances of winning are probably gone by now. But,
is this the first
test? Yeah, so do 5 tests.
So why? Tests themselves are like quite elongated affairs, aren't they?
So yeah, 5 days. So.
Call this one a wash, basically.
So call this test a wash. If they can get a draw out of this, because it was postponed through rain, so they'll be praying for rain and praying that they can just hold off Australia now. Because Australia could potentially just bat for a day and a half, put on a score of like 450, and then they'll have like an almost 300 run advantage, and then they can go back and attack England. And England will be under like mountains of pressure. Already just, you know, been bowled out for 140.
And then they're on for a whooping after that.
And then
they're on
for a proper ass whooping.
Yeah. All right, that's fair. To be fair, the way you describe it makes it sound exciting. But I've tried to watch cricket before, and it's not my cup of tea, man. But I remember them saying on the radio, when it was a rare time I listened to the radio, and they were absolutely screwing about this, man. Like, how far are we removed from the glory days of Freddie Flintoff and the lads?
I'd say a long way, man, to be honest. Yeah. In terms of our batting, obviously, I think Joe Root's the captain. He's a very good batsman. I think, like, I'm not gonna act like I'm a cricket expert, but I think that one of the best batters in the world. He's batting at fourth, I believe, and there's kind of like a bit of, all right, so these guys that are coming, a lot of these guys I haven't heard of, to be honest, that are opening, but I don't think they're good enough, to be honest. I, from a batting perspective, I don't think we're good enough.
Do you think they're kind of like trying to steady the ship with him fourth up?
I think so, yeah. And I think Stuart Broad and Jimmy Anderson, I believe, both not being selected in this test. I think they're with the squad, but they weren't selected for this test. So I think that's a massive mistake, because they're obviously both got, they're both like class bowlers. Once again, like took hundreds and hundreds of wickets. So I think that the fact that they weren't involved is a bit of a question mark. And I think that's all compounding the fact that England have got off to another poor start. And I think it does happen a lot.
Well, in a five, it's about best of five, isn't it, basically? So if they can battle to a draw here, realistically, that's all they can hope for.
That would be a massive win. If they can battle to a draw from this position, that would be a huge win.
And then start afresh from the second one. I'll be keeping an ear on this, but from what you're saying, I'm not too optimistic to bring that tiny trophy home to Edgbaston, or wherever the fuck they keep it. Like, do you know?
The urn.
The urn.
Where they keep the ashes.
Yeah. Actually, like...
Yeah, in an urn. I think there's actually a physical urn that they keep the ashes of the bales that from the first match.
Jesus Christ. That's
a bit... I could be talking absolute shit. So like any cricket fans that are listening to me and being like, Bissett, shut the fuck up. You don't know what you're talking about. Please get on and educate me. But I'm sure that's what it is.
That is satanic.
And look, we do other things during the day. Like we've got full-time jobs. Well, I haven't, but Jim has. So forgive us for not putting in the extensive knowledge. Colin Flynn.
If you're listening, son. But we'll move on to another subject where we know next to nothing about, but it was popping up on the news feed.
So I don't really know why people listen to us, to be honest. We're talking about, mind you, we are talking about two sports that are probably the furthest west from our knowledge.
Well, you were going to call me a closet F1 fan, which is so far from the truth. I think I last watched F1 on a serious level probably when Lewis Hamilton broke onto the scene, which, as a credit to his longevity, it was about 2008, I think he won his first world championship, like proper exciting stuff. But since then, he's had a habit of getting in collisions because of his aggressive racing style. And this has like happened this last weekend in Saudi Arabia, but it was more to do with this thing called DRS, which I didn't even know existed. So it's a drag reduction system, which is a flap on the back of the car, which makes you fly forward. But this system could only be activated within a second of your opponent. So the reason this collision happened on, I think it was lap 37. So Verstappen's in front, Lewis Hamilton's behind, and they've nearly collided on one corner. I remember watching the replay. They've both come out of it somehow unharmed, which is mad because F1 cars are basically like made of paper mache with like 600 horsepower, whatever the horsepower is, pretty powerful. They've managed to come out of that unscathed. Verstappen's team have told him to slow down to allow Hamilton
to go past.
Yeah, but Lewis Hamilton didn't know what was going on and he's basically sped up into the back of him. And you see from the replay, they've got cameras inside the car and all that. Hamilton's like, what the fuck is he doing? He didn't get the message from his team at the same time.
He chose to ignore it.
Well, they didn't. You get the feed, innit? But I don't know if they did some Machiavellian shit and just hid the feed. But he didn't get what he was being told from the other team. So Verstappen was told, slow down, let him pass. Hamilton didn't know what was going on. He was so close behind him. And it looked like Hamilton just being aggressive. And then they both got into a collision, but it wasn't that. So Verstappen was docked 10 points for this. So he was judged to have been basically impeding Hamilton from behind.
Was he docked 10 points or a 10-second penalty?
Yeah, 10-second penalty. Sorry, not 10 points. That'd be massive in the constructors'
standings,
title.
Yeah, yeah. Because what'd you get? Three points for a win? So no, I don't know. What'd you get? How many?
Should we just lie this off?
Yeah, should we just fucking cancel our podcast?
No, but it was... To me, I found it, even though I only step into the world of F1 momentarily once every 6 months, I was thinking DRS, why is he being ducked 10 seconds? Why is it Verstappen's fault? Do you know what I mean? I didn't understand anything that was going on. If he chooses to slow down for any reason, you haven't got an impediment to go full blast around the course if you're the track leader, do you?
How does anybody employ a 10-second penalty? Did they just say...
No, they just take your final thing and then just... take it off the end, don't it?
Oh, okay.
I take your final time, minus 10.
Oh, no way. That's mad.
Which is screwing, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's a bit of boxing when you take a point off,
isn't it? Yeah, basically. But they're neck and neck, isn't it, for the Constructors' title. So this is obviously a massive point of contention in their rivalry and the championship this year. But I still don't understand, how and why. F1 strikes me as a massively political sport. I suppose they all are, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? The most famous players or the most marketable performers get leeway, but I didn't understand. And at least the evidence from Lewis Hamilton's cockpit, whatever it's called, it actually showed that he didn't know what was going on. He was throwing up his hands straight away. He's like, I didn't know what he was doing. So I don't think, for once, I don't think you can level the charge of aggressive driving at Lewis Hamilton. So let's learn more about F1 before next time we speak about this. And then, we'll have better coverage next time.
And is Lewis Hamilton still being vilified by the Daily Mail because he's got dreads?
I think it's more his accent that's doing the Daily Mail these days.
Something to be doing the editing about him.
Yeah. Well, he's a black guy, isn't it? So
a successful black man, isn't it?
Like the absolute kingpin of F1 for the last 10 years. So I don't think the Daily Mail would be loving that man. Rated to him.
Right, so we're going to start a politics podcast now. So the President of the United States...
I think we just started by now with the last entry.
The President of the United States, Mr. Joe Biden, has announced that the country will not send diplomatic officials to the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics, citing China's human rights abuses. This appears to be in a timely nature with the controversy surrounding Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai and the omnipresent suspicion regarding the supposed concentration camps in Xinjiang of the oppressed Uyghurs. American athletes will still be permitted to attend, however, after the threat of boycott in November was revised. The last time a boycott fell short was in 1936 in Berlin, as the US planned to combat the Nazi regime just years before the outbreak of World War II. Instead, good old Jesse Owens single-handedly pissed off the whole nation by destroying all the Aryans in the sprint comps.
Showed them levels, and I think it's a bit rich of Shaky Joe to be lambasting the Chinese for abuses against Muslims, to be honest with you, when his country's been occupying massive sectors of the Middle East for the better part of 3 decades. Man, he can go fuck himself. I'm not being funny.
Bro, we are getting onto a political podcast, innit?
No, I'm not being funny, but come on.
Whoa, 4 Westerns, mate.
4, 2.5, mate. No, it's true though, isn't it? It's like we were talking earlier. We've what are we now? 8th of December, 2021. We've just had the latest lockdown restrictions imposed on us by the UK government, and the latest drug reforms. It's like they're all talking out their arses, man. And to me, the reason I mention all this is because Joe Biden is looking for the high ground. That's all it is. He's ignoring his own country's role in these similar injustices. And it's Red China, it's communism. No, come on, fuck off, man. What are you talking about?
The Democrats love that. They love that playbook, don't they?
Yeah, well, it's not to say that the Chinese are like not doing like outrageous things to a smaller population within their wider sphere, but he shouldn't be opening his mouth about it. Sorry, but...
And because we're not doing the quiz this week, and I'm gonna have to fact check this quiz question, but do you know the last time that the US boycotted an Olympics?
I will go, because I think I know this. 1980.
Yeah, spot on.
Moscow.
Yeah, it might be Moscow, but I think it was to do with the Yugoslavian invasion of somewhere, or there was something to do with the...
I can't remember what it was.
That part of the world.
But it was some communist shit, and the Soviets boycotted 1984, which, perchance, was the most successful year that the US boxing team have ever had. Evander Holyfield, Pernell Whitaker, all the lads, man.
I shouldn't have tested your Olympic knowledge. Your Olympic knowledge is pretty decent, man. So shouldn't have tested. Yeah, but this five things is dragging on because it's getting pure political now.
It's not even dragging. We're going quicker than we did over the Lewis Hamilton thing, man. To be fair.
Yeah. Broad strokes. Number four in the world of NFL. So Detroit Lions.
Lions, right?
Detroit Lions. They won a game of football for the first time in 364 days. As they beat the Minnesota Vikings 29-27 in the NFC North divisional matchup. It's scant consolation, really, for the Lions fans as they continue their miserable form as a franchise, even with new quarterback Jared Goff under center and a much-needed rebuild under the guidance of first-season head coach Dan Campbell.
Are they worse than the Bears?
Oh, way worse.
Wait, are they worse than the Falcons?
Even Bears beat them? Oh, I'd say they're worse than the Falcons as well.
Yeah, they must be pretty shit then because the Falcons are dire, aren't they?
They've never won a Super Bowl. But I think there's 12 teams that have never won a Super Bowl. I couldn't name off, obviously, off the top of my head. But I think they are the only team to go 0-16, so the full season without winning twice. I think Cleveland Browns did it not long ago. I want to say 4 or 5 years ago. But once again, anybody listening that's NFL is going to know, maybe know this. But yeah, I'm trying to pull this knowledge out of the top of my head, guys. Come on.
And you can't get relegated from the NFL, can you?
Or exactly.
Which is like... I wonder why that is. I'm sure there's loads of like football teams statewide, nationwide that would be able to like prop up the numbers.
It's American sports because at the end of the day, they want their businesses, which they are essentially. They want their business, their sports team, to be profitable all the time. And promotion, well, relegation specifically, jeopardizes that ability to market your product.
Sounding very cynical now. You're spending too much time with me, man, I reckon.
I reckon so as well. Yeah. Number five. Finally, this is for Tino as well. There's been growing support from Birmingham City fans and pundits regarding the renaming of the family stand at St Andrews to Arthur Labinjo Hughes Stand. In the wake of the news regarding the awful death of the six-year-old, his father and stepmother were last week sentenced to 21 years and 29 years respectively after the despicable torture and killing of their son during the lockdown in 2020. The board of Birmingham City are aware of the growing sentiment to name the stand after young Blue Nose Arthur. Rest in peace, little man.
You know, I don't often endorse the habits of the British judicial system, but I think sounds like a not fair, because obviously what happened to that little man was horrific, but at least they didn't get off with like 6-7 years each or whatever. Like, you know, this disgusting. Like, I've seen, like, I don't want to go down this like rabbit hole too much because that kind of that brand of abuse is particularly dark. But I think it would be a nice gesture from Birmingham City to do something like that, especially when it's like, you know. Kid, he's just a little kid, you know what I mean?
And you're not really an advocate of essentially prison and how that rehabilitates humans.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
You're literally like against it, really, in a way. But
it's not that I'm against prison. It's that I think it could be done a little bit differently. I think the way it's done now, it just punishes people, and I think that's exactly what they deserve. So yeah, I think 20 and 30 years apiece in hell, they should have 50 apiece. You know what I mean? And I hope they're subjected to the kind of horrors that they subjected him to.
Yeah, I think she already has been as well with the whole salt in the meals and stuff like that. But once again, that five things you might have missed opened up huge huge wormholes that we could have dropped down, but we managed to escape them all, I think. And hopefully you haven't bored our listeners too much.
I'm fighting back tears right now after that one. But But are we on to the combat sports already?
Let's do it.
Let's do it, man. And we'll start off with the BT Sports Show on Saturday night, which we both, again, watched on Twitter Spaces. And we're going to do these more in the future. So hopefully we can get more people involved, give people a bit more notice, and get more people on to speak with us rather than just listen to us. I think it'd be a good way to push the platform forward. So Anthony Yard levelled the score with Lyndon Arthur in their rematch last Saturday night, halting the Mancunian after four rounds of relentless pressure. We've seen Yard bash up subpar opposition plenty of times. We saw him roll the dice against Kovalev in the 8th round when he threw everything he could at the Russian champion, who ended up surviving and halting Yard in the 11th with a jab, and that was more a result of pure exhaustion than anything. And we saw in the first fight with Lyndon Arthur last year that he could be controlled and have the fight dictated to him by a domestic opposition as well. For me, there were a lot of unanswered questions over Yard coming into this fight, especially when I considered his in-ring achievements against the backdrop of the promotional hype that's prevailed during his career. All that being said, I think he was tremendous in this fight. Both men set out their stalls straight away. Yard was snappy, trying to feint his way in, closing that distance as fast as he could and punching when Arthur had nowhere to go. And there were good fast punches that forced Arthur to give ground. Arthur, for his part, tried to throw a wet blanket over Yard, which you'd say is one of those strange expressions that you'd never heard before. He tried to do that as early as possible, like reaching for clinches, as early as the first minute, trying to slow everything down. I think he showed a very good jab at times, but Yard's constant pressure and aggressive movement meant he couldn't throw or land as many as he would have liked. And when Arthur tried to clinch, Yard simply wouldn't let him. He'd shift and find punching space up close or just push Arthur away and start chasing him again. And I think this was a key aspect of the fight. Yard established a high pace and demonstrated improved skills and tactics from the first fight in maintaining this. He disguised his body shots really well. He'd lean on Arthur with the forearm and land the right hand, which is a tactic we've seen Canelo employ to great effect in his last few fights.
Praise be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, praise be. That is high praise indeed, isn't it, really? In all, Yard swiftly broke Arthur's resolve with an aggressive, polished display. The finish sequence was intense. I mean, watch it back and you can see the vein in Arthur's neck bulge when the final body shot lands. That was a man in a lot of pain. Then a final right hand to the head put him over. He was up at 9, but the ref called the fight. Arthur didn't complain, so I don't think anyone else should. I know Yard is scheduled to fight the winner of Joe Smith Jr. and Callum Johnson next year, but I'd love to see the trilogy between these two. In the first fight, Arthur controlled the fight at distance with a jabbing masterclass. Here, Yard was ferocious and calculated with the early stoppage win. Two completely different outcomes, and I want to see what happens next.
Yeah, I think fulfilling redemption for Yard, wasn't it? Obviously, he was saying he lost family members through COVID prior to the first fight, 364 days prior, and I think which he said had drastically affected his mental state leading up to the fight. So I think that had a big effect in the first loss. But with the second one, obviously he made amends, didn't he? And I think he learned from the first fight as well. So he made good on any notions that there were any excuses with his performance in the first fight Saturday night. I think he came at Arthur hard from the first round. And as you've said, although it looked like Arthur had moments in rounds 2 and 3 where it seemed that he might be able to suppress advances, he was beaten in the fourth, which you called. You absolutely called that he was going to be done within four. Within four. I wish we would have put that on the... Well, we did put it on the pod, didn't we?
I can't remember, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sure you said you said that Yard within four. But I think we would be doing Bradley Skeet, which was the undercard, wasn't it? It was
main support, I think.
The main support to this fight. And we'd be doing Bradley Skeet a gross injustice if we didn't speak about his fight with Hamza Shiraz. Shiraz, who's a 22-year-old with high expectations, came into the fight as the 1-18 favourite and was made to look bang average for the majority of this fight. I've since watched the two clearly illegal punches, and that's the way I'd call it, from Shiraz on Skeet, when the latter was clearly ahead on points in the fight. I wanted to get your clear-headed now opinion on this, days after you've had reflection on it. Should Shiraz have been disqualified in that fight?
I've watched it several times since myself, and he should absolutely have been disqualified. I know the referee, I'm forgetting his name now, he deducted a point and he had a little word with Shiraz. That is not enough. I'll take you back to this is an older example. So you could point and say, well, British Boxing Border Control's rules are different from this. But Roy Jones Jr. lost his undefeated record against, what's his name now? Not Forrest Griffin. He was punched. He punched a guy while he was down, basically, and it was one shot. Not like a three-punch combination that Shearer's landed on Bradley Skeet. And this is Roy Jones, pinnacle of the sport. They didn't bother protecting him. They said, no, that's well out of order. You can't do that. You're gone. For me, after Skeet was boxing the head off him, so confident, hands down, lateral movement, baiting him on, showing him veteran moves. You know what I mean? We were watching it going, I can't believe this is happening, because clearly the promotion was set up to favour Shiraz, wasn't it? 22 years old, a lot of height, massive freakish dimensions. He looks like he's about 7 foot, massive levers. Obviously, he's going to grow into higher weight divisions. Skeet has had a couple of devastating losses on the road. 34 years old, now up at 154 for I think the first time in his career. This was all in Shiraz's favour. And it stunk of just the home fighter favouritism for me. I think it was disgusting. He got punched 3 times in the head while he was down. It's not up to Bradley Skeet to play act and say, I can't continue. It's the referee's job to say, no, that's not on, you're out of here.
Yeah, it's not his fault for not play acting, is it? And at the end of the day, I don't want to try and use comparisons from other sports, but it's in the realm of combat sports. But Petr Yan, when he was disqualified against Aljamain Sterling, I know the rules are different between boxing and MMA, but whatever the rules are, which I don't know, and you probably will, but if the rule says, if a fighter's knees down and you get punched, like, it's disqualification, how on earth was he not disqualified? If that's the rules? Is that the rule, or...?
And again, I can't speak to the specific rule pertaining to what happens when you punch the downed opponent. I've still got my little green British Boxing Board of Control handbook somewhere in the house, and I might fish it out just for this specific purpose. I imagine there's something in there regarding the referee's discretion. And I don't think the referee was strong enough in this instance. He punched him 3 times. One of them was a glancing blow. One uppercut went straight down the middle of his forehead, and that was a full-blooded shot.
And obviously the referee acknowledged it because he took a point away.
Yeah.
So what does a fighter need to do to get disqualified then?
Well, you have to not be the home fighter. You have to not have all this hype behind you. Honestly, it was so disgusting. Like, we were watching, we were shouting at the telly, like, how the fuck can you allow this to continue? Skeet, fair play to him. Again, it's not his job to be brave and carry on. He was stopped in the next round. Come on. Do you know what I mean? And this is going to go down. People aren't going to remember. This is what makes my blood boil. People won't remember this. They'll look at that and say, Shiraz, KO.
Honestly, I've seen nothing about it on social media. Nothing about it. The only time it was mentioned was when I was driving to London on Monday. It was on TalkSport, and they briefly spoke about it for about 5 minutes because they mentioned the Anthony Yard versus Lyndon Arfon fight. And Simon Jordan asked a boxing expert about it. And his kind of view was like, yeah, he should have been disqualified. But I've heard nothing more from the media about it.
They should have made a massive deal about it, because if Shiraz is going to be pushed the way I imagine he's going to be pushed towards world titles, 154, 160, 168 probably, they're not going to talk about this, man. It happens all the time. I can't even like bring up the amount of time this happens to favoured prospects. It's disgusting, man. Boxing's so dirty, man. I don't know. Like, I know why I keep watching it, because I do actually love watching it. But this backroom stuff, this politicking, this underhandedness, this...
You're political bastards!
Exactly, man. No, it's true. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I wasn't gonna. Do you know what I mean? So I'm part of the problem myself. I should have been, like, you know, screaming about it the whole time. But, again, I don't think it makes any difference. But that was... it was a good night of boxing, really.
We had, what's his name? I think it will rear its ugly head in the future, though, I think.
I hope so, man, because, you know, Bradley Skeet, they're not going to do that rematch. And I think in the rematch, Shiraz will probably do better. Do you know what I mean? Because he's on the come up. He's got all the resources around him. But fair play to Bradley Skeet for the performance he put up to that point, for getting some of his prime back at 34 years of age, in a weight class above, with a new trainer, with everything against him. He boxed circles around that kid.
Big up. You know
what I mean? Yeah, straight up, man. So we'll leave that behind. I'll let my pulse calm down for a little sec. And we'll go beyond our borders to two of the top lightweights in the world. Devin Haney and Gervonta Davis both won 12-round decisions over Jojo Diaz and Isaac Cruz, respectively. Haney was composed, showing good boxing variation, especially with mixing up the speed of his punches within combinations. He did show some defensive frailty, but never looked close to being in trouble, as he did against Jorge Linares a few months ago. The southpaw Diaz, he edged forward all night, but didn't seem at all bothered by Haney's power, which is a concern for Haney moving forward, I think. He had decent success with the left hand throughout, but couldn't match Haney for volume. And Haney was a well-deserved winner on points. I think slowly but surely, he's growing beyond what I thought he was.
And if I remember rightly, I think you compared him to Floyd Mayweather.
No. I haven't compared him to Floyd.
Are you sure?
I mean,
I assure you, a while ago.
I wouldn't say I definitely haven't, but I don't see that much Floyd in him. There are certain aspects of his game that he looks like Floyd, but to me, he's more. The main difference between Haney and Floyd for me is that Haney's always leaning forward, and Floyd was more side on with a complete centre of gravity, ready to spring any way that he needed to. I think Haney leaves himself in punching range way more often than Floyd would. There are certain comparisons there, for sure, but I don't think they're quite the same lineage. But that's not to say Haney can't become that fighter. You know, he's still a young kid himself. 22, 23, something like that. Plenty of time.
Obviously got wobbled by Linares, didn't he? I think remember when his legs kind of went for a minute, but he was right at the end of the round, wasn't it?
But there are certain commonalities, but I would stop short completely saying he's the next Floyd. Gervonta Davis, on the other hand, he was breathtaking. He showed Isaac Cruz every look in the book. He was elusive, explosive, inventive. At one point in the seventh, he landed about 7 left hands in a row. So I don't want to whip out another blasphemous comparison, but I see Pernell Whitaker in Gervonta Davis. I really do.
I'm going to call you up on this in another 3 months.
I'd be much more comfortable with this one, to be honest with you. He's much more aggressive and powerful than Whitaker, obviously. But he throws punches, and he already knows where he's going to go to avoid the retaliation. He's thinking 2 steps ahead, and he's so fast, and his left hand is so destructive with every shot. I think he's my favourite of the lot of lightweight. I know he hasn't been exposed to the same the same quality of opposition as Kambosos, Teofimo Lopez, Lomachenko, but that's promotional shit. Cruz didn't come to lie down either. He's only the second fighter to go the distance with Davis in his 26th fight pro career, and looked as fresh as is possible at the end of the fight after 36 minutes of action with a renowned puncher. So, promotional conflict, the shift in championship arrangement, the travel complications, means the top end of the lightweight scene is impossible to predict. But alongside Devin Haney and Gervonta Davis, there's Vasyl Lomachenko, Ryan Garcia, Teofimo Lopez, and now the newly crowned unified lightweight champion, George Kambosos. It's red hot 135.
I can see them belts getting passed around another 3 or 4 times in the next five odd years.
Well, the COVID shit in Australia is going to be a massive impediment to this. And I think Kambosos has said, like, come see me in Australia. But I don't know if that's going to be possible. I think the US are going to have much more relaxed conditions and requirements for that. I think he's going to have to stay over there. But I don't think that'll be a problem to him.
It wasn't a problem. Against Tio, it wasn't a problem for him, was it?
No. But again, man, Gervonta Davis, I think he's a different kettle of fish, man. I'm telling you. I think he's the one. But we'll see. We'll see. I'd love to see my favourite.
Him and Lomachenko.
Him and Lomachenko. I'd love to see that, man. Because they're both similar sizes as well. Like, Devin Haney, he's like a little bit. He fights like quite short, but he's actually a taller guy. Ryan Garcia. He's a much taller than the rest of them. Hasn't been as active. I think people underestimate his win against Luke Campbell. People just brushed it off as, oh, he should have beaten. But Luke Campbell's an Olympic gold medalist, 2-time world championship contender. Pushed Jorge Linares all the way when he was in better condition than when Haney fought him. I don't think you can undermine his achievements so far either.
I don't want to feel like I'm calling you out, but I do remember you criticised. Comparisons to the Three Kings era.
Yeah, the Four Kings
era. Yeah, the Four Kings era in the lightweight division. So, where do you stand on that now?
Oh, I stand by them completely. They're nowhere near those lads. They're nowhere near them. Come on.
But what about the excitement? What can this do to generate excitement?
Don't get me wrong. I'm excited by these lads. I think it's a great thing that you've got so many high-level operators around the championship at the same time, and they all seem to be calling each other out, and the ingredients are all there. But do not compare these lads to Sugar Ray Leonard, to Tommy Hearns, to Marvin Hagler, to Roberto Duran. I'm sorry, that is just ridiculous. It is just ridiculous, man. But what? That's not to say that they can't go on and achieve like legitimate things. They've already achieved. All of them have already achieved legitimate things in the sport of boxing. But we're talking next level status, and they're not there yet for me. I would like them to.
We need to see all of those lightweights fighting each other for the next 5 years, man. That's all we need, isn't it?
Yeah, never gonna happen.
That would cement. Like this period in this weight category in the lightweight division as being like the best, potentially one of the best of all time, and they did that, but it won't happen, as you say, because of promotional conflicts.
If there was a gun to my head, I'd say that's never going to happen. But we'll see. I've got my fingers crossed. I would like to be optimistic. But there was one MMA fight I want to quickly touch on before we get onto the preview for next week. Jose Aldo beat Rob Font in the UFC Fight Night main event last Saturday. We've spoken about Font's prowess with the jab, but Aldo, now 35, still chiseled like a rock.
I look great.
He grabbed his 31st career win and a third in a row with a striking display that was hard and direct going forward, and with a defence that was just elusive enough to keep him out of any real danger. He dropped Font several times in the fight and actually finished the fight on Font's back, triangle locked around the hips, and came very close to grabbing the late submission. A wide unanimous decision win for Aldo, who said he wants Dillashaw next, and that's a brave statement given how tired he looked in the later stages against Font, but he's earned his right to do whatever he wants to do. That McGregor loss, KO'd in 13 seconds in the biggest fight of his life, would have swallowed a lot of men whole. He's shown great character and perseverance to bounce back the way he has, and maximum Zanskow for that, man. Little Bruno reference for you, for all the boys.
It's going straight out of my head. But yeah, I think it all looked tidy for Font. In the early exchanges, I think he was getting good touches on Aldo initially, trying to control the distance. But then in the dying second of that round, Aldo landed a beautiful straight right, didn't he? And that shook Font. And had there been, say, 10 more seconds in that round, it probably would have been all over then.
Yeah, I think you're right, to be honest.
But he landed this exact same combination early on in the second, didn't he? Little touch with his left, and then the straight right got through the guard. But to be honest, man, it just looked like Aldo had more power than Font. Like bigger, leaner, meaner. That's just the way he looked for me when I was watching back the highlights. And then it ultimately took its toll on Font. I think he had him in trouble on like numerous occasions, didn't he? I think for me, I'll get your opinion on this. The only criticism for Aldo at the moment would be his ability to finish his opponents. As you say, going later into the rounds, looking tired. If he wants to go and fight Yan again or Volkanovski again, both that he's lost to, or TJ Dillashaw, they're operating on different levels, the fight, aren't they?
I think Dillashaw, drug scandal notwithstanding, I think you basically have to say notwithstanding to that, because for anyone who's halfway interested in doping in sports, check out Joe Rogan's recent episode with the guy, what's he called, More Plates, More Dates.
Oh, he's never promoting fucking Joe Rogan. In the early days, you're always promoting it.
But I'm telling you, he talks about how, I don't really listen to him that much now, but he talks about if fighters and athletes get actual scientists on their team, how easy it is to pass these tests. So I don't think it's a mark against an athlete's name to use performance-enhancing drugs. That's basically my stance. So the reason I mention that is because of Dillashaw. He's recently come off the EPO scandal. His endurance, EPO up or not, would give Aldo a lot of problems. And regardless of the drug scandal, TJ Dillashaw is a motherfucker, man. He wants to win. I mean, you've seen against Corey Sandhagen, a geezer who was 6 inches taller, throwing flying knees all over the place, inventive, this, that, and the other. He still managed to drag out a split decision victory after 2 years on the shelf and a knee injury going into the fight. And coming off a shoulder surgery as well. That's the kind of guy you're dealing with. I don't like Aldo's chances in that fight at all. I agree with you, Petr Yan, Volkanovski, completely different level. I don't even see the point in those rematches. But, as I said, he's achieved what he's achieved. If they give him the payday, I'm happy with that. I want to see him do well.
I think he deserved it.
Yeah. And then staying with the UFC, this weekend, UFC 269, headlined by the steel-shinned man from Louisiana, Dustin Poirier, fresh off his trilogy win against Conor McGregor. The champion Charles Oliveira won the title in a dynamic, explosive display against Michael Chandler in May. He's one of the most elite submission artists in the UFC. His Thai boxing is nasty. His durability and composure are at that championship level. Poirier has shown how effective his aggressive boxing can be, how willing to push the pace he is. But I think stylistically, this is a big ask for him. Very much looking forward to this. Do you have any thoughts on this one?
I like them both. So I wouldn't want to see either of these guys lose that fight, man, because I think they were both really, really impressive last time out. So it's difficult to call this one as well, isn't it? Because they're both... Would you say both fighters are in their prime?
Well, it's a funny thing about being a championship fighter. I think a lot of them get to the title when they're at the end of their prime, basically, because you have to go, especially in the UFC, you have to run the gauntlet to get to the title. If I had to guess, I would say Oliveira's the fresher man, even though he's got a lot more fights. I think he's fresher. I think he's taking less damage. And I think... I like the way he was able to navigate the early rounds against Chandler and literally just rely on his technique and his composure. Left hook, dropped him out of there. Poirier, we've seen him go to the well so many times. And I think if it was just a stand-up fight, like we've seen Poirier against Eddie Alvarez, against Dan Hooker, against Conor McGregor, where there's very little submission danger, I would favour him. But then you see Poirier against Khabib, and you see what happens when someone who's that more advanced than him, you see what happens there. And I think it's going to follow a similar path. Not that smash and grab and pass and choke and what Khabib was known for, but I think Oliveira's going to find some sneaky little spots in there. In the co-main event, the lioness Amanda Nunes defends her bantamweight title against Juliana Pena. You only have to look at Nunes' resume. Ronda Rousey, Holly Holm, Miesha Tate, Valentina Shevchenko, Chris Cyborg. And with the exception of Valentina, who has since gone on to put together a very impressive record as the flyweight champion, Nunes stopped all of these women, all former champions. Nunes has basically single-handedly disposed of an entire generation of fighters. This is a word of warning though. Whenever I'm so convinced to back an MMA fighter, they always lose. So I won't call this a certainty. But Juliana Pena is going to need the performance of a lifetime to win this fight. I'm a massive, massive Nunes fan. I'm telling you, she's alpha. Do you know what I mean?
Amanda Nunes versus Valentina Shevchenko. Now, who wins?
Nunes, I think. It's the size. And, Shevchenko was again, plugging JRE from Nerves. She was on there before. Probably 3 or 4 weeks ago, and she said she wants that fight again. Shevchenko, massive fan of her, man.
She was amazing.
She's
last time out.
She's a fucking assassin. And she said the only difference between me and her is size, and I think that's probably right, to be honest with you. That's why I'd favour Nunes again. She's a big girl, man. I mean, even when she moved up, I think probably the most devastating victory of her career is that one against Chris Cyborg. No one wanted to fight Chris Cyborg for ages. Ronda Rousey was ducking and diving. The UFC didn't know what to do with her when she signed because no one wanted to fight her, which meant that plucky challengers from seventh in the rankings, they didn't even exist for the featherweight weight class. And Nunes just went in and fucking smoked her. Cyborg was thinking she's not big enough to handle me. Nunes flew at her, and that's one of the most impressive knockouts you'll see, man. Pena, God bless her, but nah, I don't think this is gonna happen. I'm really looking forward to that fight now. But let's move on to the boxing preview for next week. It's absolutely crazy. I don't know if the lads are trying to get paid before Christmas or what, but this is some rundown. So we've got Vasyl Lomachenko versus Richard Comey for one of the lightweight titles. We've got Conor Benn versus Chris Algieri. We've got Katie Taylor versus Vera Sharapova. We've got Nonito Donaire versus Raymond Gabalo. Dmitry Bivol versus Umar Salamov, Sonny Edwards versus Jason Mama, and Paul Butler versus John Real Casimiro. So, with the exception of Ben Algieri, all of these are for one world title or another, and Bivol Salamov notwithstanding, I think they'll all be cracking fights. I mean, if we do a quick run through, what I expect from him, Lomachenko looked back to his best against Nakatani in his comeback after losing his belts to Teofimo Lopez. He's iron-willed, the legs are still there, and I think he'll dance circles around Comey, to be honest. I mean, you described Comey as a journeyman, maybe last week or the week before. I don't agree with that at all, but I think Lomachenko might make him look like a journeyman. Katie Taylor in her fight will throw with both hands from the first round to the last. I hope the opponent is willing, though I've never seen her before, but you have to favour Taylor in that fight. Nonito Donaire at 39 is still an absolute pleasure to watch. He's an all-time great for me. He's got a left hook from the gods. He's got the veteran guile. He's still somehow faster than most of his opponents. I'm unashamedly willing him to victory. Paul Butler is in very hard against Casemiro, who just beat one of my favourites, Guillermo Rigondo, by split decision. I think Butler will do well to hit the final bell here, to be honest. As for Sonny Edwards, he didn't stand still for half a breath when he beat Methelani for the flyweight title in April. When he wants to go missing, he's a very difficult man to find, let's just put it that way. I've never seen his opponent Mama, but he's 24, he's from the Philippines, he's undefeated at 16-0. And he might just be in for a frustrating night's work.
Once again, it's like we were speaking on the weekend and we were referencing a guy from... There was a fighter that was fighting one of the British guys. And we were sort of like, where did he kind of get the idea to bring these guys in?
Yeah, it was. It was Dennis McCann's opponent.
Yeah, was he a Mexican guy?
No, Argentinian.
Argentinian guy, yeah, that was it. We were speaking about, like, where do the promoters find these guys and how do they decide on, all right, this is the perfect match for my fighter at this moment in time?
I think half of it's, like, rankings, half of it's, like, records. Half, you can't have three halves, but like these are all these are all components of the recipe. I would never overrule a fighter from the Philippines because they just have a certain national characteristic about them. They all seem to be pretty tough. They all seem to be able to hit pretty hard. Casemiro is an example of that. I would beware of the late step in Filipino because, as we know, Manny Pacquiao stepped in against Ledwaba in 2001 and
created... We knew who he was, really. Yeah,
he created a dynasty for himself that lasted the better part of a quarter of a century. So, no, I'm not saying that every Filipino is going to do that, but he's created a massive road down which all Filipino fighters wish to follow. So, Conor Benn, he takes another step up the ladder against the caged tiger, Chris Algieri. Benn shows improvements every time I see him. I know Algieri's 37 now, and he's been semi-retired the last few years, but he's a former world champion who's only been stopped once in his three losses, and that was to Errol Spence. He's a big lump, he's mobile, he's got a good long jab, and he can do 12 rounds no problem. If Benn wins this fight, I'll be very impressed indeed.
I think I remember you saying that you weren't a fan of Conor Benn's personality particularly. I was reading a really good article about him in the Daily Mail today. And he was talking about his upbringing, and I think he was brought up in Spain, and he was sent to sort of like one of these sort of like almost radicalist Catholic schools or something, and they were like, you know, sort of like, what do you call it, the power of Christ compels you, kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? And he was I don't think he was on good terms with his old man and his mom because of it. I don't think he really built the bridges back up with his dad until like the age of 18. So it sounds like he's had a bit of a rough upbringing, man. So,
well, you know, I probably haven't been the biggest fan of his personality, but I want to clarify that a little bit. Is the side of his personality I'm not a fan of is what I've seen on the camera, which is not a true reflection of his personality, considering how young he's been, and like how his age when he first went into Matchroom. Like, I've only seen him as a kid developing in front. There's certain expectations. His dad's Nigel Benn, for fuck's sake. Do you know what I mean? There are going to be certain pressures that are going to make you act a certain way, and social media, da da da. I've got no real sense of who he is as a person. So I'm just saying that he's just said some irritating things to me. Like on YouTube, on IFL. That doesn't really play into my opinion of him, to be honest with you.
But he's still undefeated, isn't he? So he's
still undefeated, and recently, especially against Sammy Vargas, I think he looked devastating. And I think, what's that lad he fought last time? Granados. I thought he looked very good over 10 rounds against him. And as I said, against Algeria, if he beats Algeria, I'm gonna start considering him as like, oh...
On the hype train.
Yeah, not on the hype train, but I rate Algeria quite highly, to be honest with you. Even now, at the later stage of his career, you think about the guys that have beat Algeria. It's Amir Khan, Errol Spence, and Manny Pacquiao. Those are the guys that have beat him. And I don't care if he's 37. He's like a fitness instructor. He never gets out of shape. He can move and jab all night long. I think that's going to be a problem for Benn, who I think is going to be quite undersized in his fight. And if he can get around that, and like, if he gets to him early, I will be on the hype train then, for sure. But I've come onto the Dmitry Bivol one, and this guy frustrates me a little bit, because I've come to expect 12 round decision wins from him. His last five have gone the distance after a better KO percentage early in his career. He's technically proficient. He's quick and he fights defense first in that upright Eastern style. Salimov looks like a very good body puncher. He gets decent leverage with those long levers and can be quite aggressive. I mean, not knowing too much about Salimov, I often lean towards the fighter with the better defense. And so here I'll have to lean towards Bivol. And Bivol was one of those people who was in the Canelo like sweepstakes, really. Is he going to move up to 175 to fight Bivol?
Yeah, because I think Bivol and Baturbia. Share the belts in that light division.
And to be honest, I think Bivol would be like a headache for Canelo to deal with, and it wouldn't be a good fight. So I can completely understand why they bypassed that to go towards Makabu at cruiserweight. So yeah, it's hard for me to get excited about a Bivol fight. But hopefully Salimov is able to... hopefully Salimov's aggressive enough to bring out some kind of quick reactions and a quick KO, but that's beyond my my wildest hopes and dreams, to be honest. But that's it. That's it for another week.
That's going to be a busy weekend for you reviewing all these fights, man.
Oh, man. Don't know. Well,
looking forward to it, but not looking forward to it. I think all Sunday you're going to be watching fights, aren't you,
well, basically? University has come to a close for Christmas this week, so I've got the extra time now. But Sunday I'll be right off. India's going to be screwing, man.
I'll be half tempted to stay up Saturday night because I'll be in Manchester visiting some friends. I wonder if I can wait out and watch the UFC, maybe.
Nah, you ain't going to stay up, man.
Nah, I ain't. I'll be in bed by 12
you'll be,
o'clock.
Yeah, right? You'll be sleeping, man, snoring your head off. But yeah, Sunday's the day to catch up on everything, man.
Yeah, thanks for listening to another episode. Obviously, we're trying to do a little bit more on the socials. We're just trying to edge and give everybody, all our listeners, more stuff. We're doing a lot more of these. We've done about three of them now, haven't we? We did one on the boxing, which didn't really get much attraction.
Yeah, the FA Cup draw got a lot of interaction.
Yeah, the Twitter spaces. Yeah. And the FA Cup draw was brilliant. Yeah, we had sort of about 10 people listening at one point, and we had a few people chipping in. Obviously, big up Mohammed for having his piece about Manchester United. It's always good to speak about, you know, passionate fans that, you know, want to talk about their own team.
Or whatever they want to talk about, man.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So
even like, you probably school us on the F1 or whatever. I'd love to hear an actual breakdown from someone sitting from here to there, so like explaining what we don't know about. Do you know what I mean? All sports, all perspectives, all opinions, they're all welcome.
Yeah, so make sure you check us out on social media, as always. So we'll be trying to roll it on. Flynn will be back next week. And hopefully we'll have Stevie next week as well. So it'll be a four-man thing next week.
Yeah, sweet. Looking forward to it. Hopefully we get them both on. But if not, we'll keep it rolling anyway.
All right, pleasure as always, Jim.
Respect.